أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله أشهد أن محمد رسول
Hello, welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. We're continuing with our 10th series dealing with the sources of Islam. Today we'll continue our discussion of the authorship of the Quran. This is our 5th program dealing with this particular topic. We'll be examining the role that visions may have played in the revelation of the Quran. I have joining me on the program, as usual, my good friend Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Before we get into today's program, could I have you go back and just quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our 4th program on this topic of authorship of the Quran, where we're discussing the possible role of epilepsy?
Sure. Well, in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th programs in this series, and the main question, as you said, was to examine who is the author of the Quran. And the first 3 programs in that particular topic, 2, 3, and 4, focused mainly on the issue of deliberate fabrication, whether the Prophet might have deliberately claimed that the Quran is from Allah while he was himself the author of it. In the 5th segment that we discussed last week, we started to analyze the position of those who could not help when they studied the life of the Prophet but admit his truthfulness, but still try to reconcile that with the rejection of the Quran as divine revelation by seeking some kind of psychic explanation. So the last program was mainly the issue of the epilepsy, whether epilepsy had anything to do with the revelation of the Quran. To approach that question, we started first by summarizing the information that we have historically about the state of the Prophet when he received revelation, and then we went to the authorities in psychiatry to examine the nature of epilepsy, how it's defined, what are the various types of epilepsy, mm-hmm. the 4 various types that we discussed before. And by examining them, we have seen that their symptoms are quite inconsistent and not really related in any essential way to the experience of the Prophet during the state of revelation. And then we concluded that the Quran, after all, is available in our hands, and if anyone suspects that this is a result of epileptic seizure, let him or her read the Quran. And we know that people in epilepsy would not utter such kind of wisdom. And like I said before, some people say that if this is the product of epilepsy, then we can do with a lot more epileptic people like that. It's just something that's totally unreasonable to assume. And maybe that's why, comparatively, this painting of Prophet Muhammad as an epileptic person, while still persists in some writing, seem to have been less than it used to be in the past. Because, again, modern information on epilepsy does not seem to support that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, turning to our discussion today, I wonder if I could have you first of all explain to us the idea of visions and how, in your opinion, it relates to the explanation of the source of the Quran.
Well, this is another attempt, again, to reconcile admitting that the person is truthful and sincere, but in the meantime saying, no, what he said came from himself without feeling it. And the basic notion behind it is that they say a person who is deeply religious may go through certain religious or spiritual experience or visions, and in these visions he may think that his own thoughts have a different source. So without really deliberately lying or changing, a person may sincerely think that this idea is actually came to him from some outside source. The classical example that some people perhaps give on this experience is the story of Joan of Arc. And it's very strange that some people try to make an analogy between that and or similar, you know, religious visions and the revelation of the Quran. It's just like saying the elephant and the trees are basically the same because both of them have trunks. I mean, the comparison, which is too far-fetched, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting. I haven't ever heard of that myself. I wonder if perhaps I could ask you to just briefly tell us about Joan of Arc and how the connection sometimes is tempting to be made. How does it relate to the revelation of the Quran?
Well, Joan of Arc, as described by a historian, was a pious and deeply religious young girl who was at the same time also a staunch nationalist. France at that time was under the, that's the 15th century you're talking about, in the Christian era, was under the domination and rule of the British. And this girl so much loved her country that she really wanted to liberate her country from this foreign domination. She tried all means to seek all kind of help in order to mobilize and motivate her people to gain their independence. Part of that was even seeking the help of the government. But in this kind of political or charged political atmosphere and nationalism and love of the country, she became or began to be convinced, as historians say, that she is destined to lead her people towards liberation. That's why you find her speaking about voices and visions that she claimed has come to her. This claim or experience that she reported was very enthusiastically accepted by her people, who were, by the way, as some historian described them, very prone to this type of things. So they accepted that explanation, became very staunch followers of Joan of Arc, and that led eventually to their victory in Lorient in 1429. Now, the point here is that it is interesting to talk about the story of Joan of Arc, but it is totally inexcusable to make an analogy between Joan of Arc and revelation to prophets, let alone to the last prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Because you're really comparing here a limited phenomenon, sort of visions, which could happen also in many cases other than the story of Joan of Arc. Something which is quite limited, leading a particular political movement for a certain period or for a given purpose, liberation at this time, an attitude which was enforced by religiosity and deep faith and the piety of the individual on one hand, and the revelation given to the prophets, which is a much more wide and comprehensive reformation, not only intended for one purpose or under certain circumstances, but something that is much more lasting, with a comprehensive coverage of areas of belief, moral behavior, a total outline for a social system, sometimes even economic, like the case of Islam, economic and political system. Something that has really changed the history of humanity in a very fundamental way, something which was accompanied by stunning quote-unquote miracles, or something that really could not be challenged at all by those skeptics and led many of them actually to believe in those prophets. So we're really talking about revelation given to the prophets, followed by hundreds and upon hundreds of millions of people over hundreds of years. And to compare that with a limited phenomena like Joan of Arc is definitely something which is really not very relevant. Mm-hmm. And I was really quite amazed, you know, that in a new encyclopedia called the New Catholic Encyclopedia, that they, without any analysis, they just make this connection automatically as if it's a matter of course between Joan of Arc and revelation of the Quran, which is is lacking really in substance.
Well, I wonder if perhaps I could get you to elaborate a bit more on the gist of this theory and how was it applied to Prophet Muhammad.
Well, one of the proponents of that theory is a person that some people view as a much better writer about Islam in a sense of being reasonably fair and less biased than many writers who preceded him. But again, he falls into the same problem of not going far enough to admit the divine revelation of the Quran. That's Dermingham, Emil Dermingham, in his book, The Life of Muhammad. His basic theory is that, and that's not only his, there are others also who seem to follow the same way of thinking, like Tor Andre, for example. And he says that the kind of sincerity and purity of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, might have led him, in fact, to reject the kind of corruption and lack of belief or faith in God and this kind of paganism that was rampant among his people, that he, because of his instinctive pure nature and sincerity, through his own internal light, he saw that these things are wrong. So he had this pure innate nature with him. He did not participate in the modes of worship that his people did or their evil deeds. And then he continues on that he may have thought and contemplated about the need and the hope that his people will improve and come to faith in God and improve on their moral behavior and be guided to the truth. And then he goes on, he said, Prophet Muhammad might have also heard something about the beliefs of the Jews and Christians, and perhaps he did not accept many of their ideas, like Trinity, for example. He did not find it a very appealing way of explaining about the Creator, divinity. He says also he might have heard about a prophet who was expected or prophesied to come about that time, and in some cases even the prophecies was that he would be coming from that area. And he said that maybe this or these thoughts and ideas, with all sincerity, might have gone into his mind and kept gelling in his subconscious until he was convinced, or as Tor Andre, another writer, puts it, until he convinced himself, or really had some kind of secret desire that he was not aware of, that he will be the reformer or the prophet of that time. And this kind of conviction with sincerity led him to somehow think or feel, in other words, in a more direct way to say, had some kind of illusion of voices speaking to him, or even visual illusions of people talking to him, which he thought were angels and all that. And whatever he thought of in his subconscious, it came into the open, and he sincerely thought that this was revelation from Allah, from God, that is, the in the form of the Quran. And sometimes you will find, especially Dermingham, presenting this theory in a very lovely and romantic way, that the Prophet used to go in the desert, stay up there in the mountain, in the cave, look at the silence, or at the, during the silence of the night, at the sparking stars and the soft light of the moon and the expanse of sand. In some cases they talk also about waves, which was quite far away. Yes. A very romantic picture in the silence of the night. Think and contemplate about the creation, who created that, about destiny of mankind and purpose of creation, and the ideas kept coming into his mind and all that. So, I mean, very romantic and beautiful presentation, but romantic, yes, beautiful, yes, but whether it really meets scholarly rigor in terms of its analysis and correctness, well, this is another thing.
Well, now, what argumentation or reasoning could you put forward that this explanation is, in fact, incorrect and would not stand the test of good scholarship.
Okay. It does not stand it because you could possibly say that a human being may be under some kind of illusion for some time, maybe for a few months, a couple of years even. You might even say that it could happen. And you could say that whatever the person says under this state of illusion may be, in fact, a product of his own thinking, just it's coming from his subconscious. You could possibly say that. I mean, I wouldn't dispute that much. It could happen. But the point that is forgotten in this kind of theory is that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, continued his message for a period of 23 years. And consistently, throughout this period, he reported exactly the same thing. That the angel was coming to him, that he was dictating the Quran, he was uttering the Quran in front of everybody else, and everybody was keeping a record of that. Well, to say that for 23 years he was convincing himself that this Quran came from some outside source, given what we know about his personality and his wisdom, is really to accuse him of being somebody who's not really what he in fact is. It just totally doesn't make any sense. But what is even more important is that this sort of visions or illusions which are only a product of subconscious would have to be related to the individual's own experience. In other words, if it came from his subconscious, after all, it came basically from his knowledge,
mm-hmm,
and his experience and his environment, if you will. And as such, it might reflect psychologically his own thinking. But when you objectively examine the Quran, you will find there are ample evidence that there are so many things in the Quran that could have never emanated from the Prophet's mind, whether the conscious or subconscious. This includes the fact that in the Quran there are mention of certain historical things that happened in the past that was not known to the Prophet or to his people around him. Now, you cannot say that this comes from the subconscious. It's specific, concrete knowledge of what happened in the past. Secondly, in the Quran there are prophecies about future events that are going to take place, and sometimes the description is so vivid and so clear, and these things came to pass in the exact way that the Quran mentioned. Again, how could that come from the subconscious? Thirdly, from the purely psychological point of view, there are many indications in the Quran and proofs that the nature of what is there in the Quran shows that psychologically could have not come from the own mind or own thinking of the Prophet. I'm just mentioning them in general. Of course, each one of them has to be challenged and analyzed. And fourthly, even from the purely scientific standpoint, we will find that there are so many things in the Quran that scientists have only discovered hundreds of years after the Prophet, and it was not known at his time. So again, how could he have that infinite knowledge to say something scientifically that was not known even for hundreds of years after his death? Again, how could this have come from his subconscious or his limited experience or knowledge, let alone the fact that he was an illiterate person or unlettered in an environment which was not really advanced in any science or...
Well, you mentioned that each one of these perhaps should be challenged. Maybe it might be appropriate for us to spend some time examining these points in order.
Sure.
Looking first of all at the question of information with respect to past history. How does this information about past history in the Quran show that Prophet Muhammad could not have been the author of the Quran, in your opinion?
Well, the Quran mentioned lots of stories about things that happened in the past, all the way from the time of creation even,
yes,
on. But more particularly, there are lots of stories also about the prophets, previous prophets, prior to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And by the way, not all of these are identical to what we find in previous scriptures, like the Bible, for example. And this perhaps you can come to at a later time,
mm-hmm,
when we speak about the possibility that the Bible could have been a source of the Quran. That's another topic altogether.
Yes.
And it is well known that history is a specific knowledge. It's not something that emanates because of insight in the individual. It's specific information, something that actually happened in the past. So it cannot come from subconscious,
mm-hmm,
it could, at all. The only way it comes is through the person himself learning, mm-hmm. or learning that from other people. Now, we have to, like they say, you can't have your cake and eat it. You see, if you're assuming that he learned that history or these stories in the Quran from previous sources, or read it himself, or he didn't know how to read or write, but even if you assume for the sake of argument, then of course the assumption here would be that he knew from some other source and claimed that this came from God, which would go into, again, the deliberate fabrication, which you have discussed amply in some of the previous programs. So either you assume that, or you assume, as Dermingham and others say, that it came from his own subconscious. But again, that's illogical, because subconscious doesn't tell you history. It's specific information.
Yes.
You follow the point?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing is that some people might say, all right, well, maybe some of these stories of the prophets were known in general, so without deliberately giving a different source or anything, he might have this in the back of his mind, general acquaintance with what happened. But to answer that question, we find that there are amazing things in the Quran that shows that it's very meticulous, and that this information did not just come by way of general familiarity at all. Take for example the story of the seven sleepers, or as known in Islam as Ahl al-Kahf, as described in Surah 18 in the Quran. Not only does it mention the story of the seven sleepers, but it says, and that's an amazing part of it, وَلَبِثُوا فِي كَهْفِهِمْ 300 سِنِينَ وَازْدَادُوا 9. They stayed in their cave, that's the sleepers, 300 years plus 9. It is put in such a strange way. Why did it not say 309 years?
Mm-hmm.
Why 300 years and increased by 9? If you keep in mind that the Muslims and Arabs in general used the lunar calendar.
Yes.
And if we know that the lunar year is about 11 days shorter than the solar year,
mm-hmm.
and if you multiply 11 days by 300 years and divide it by 365, you will end up with exactly 9 years. And that is revealed to people who didn't know calculation, never used this. As the Prophet indicated that, and nobody challenged, نحن أمة أمية, we are illiterate people. So for this meticulous expression to be mentioned in the Quran, one cannot say, well, you know, it was just a general familiarity. And this is only but one example of it. But there is even a stronger evidence. In the Quran, a challenge is made which was not met by anyone, Muslim or non-Muslim. In Surah 11, verse 49, after the Quran described some of these stories of the Prophet, it says, تلك من أنباء الغيب نوحيها إليك ما كنت تعلمها أنت ولا قومك من قبل هذا. It says, these are knowledge that we reveal unto you, O Muhammad, from the unseen. Neither you nor your people had any knowledge of that before it, that is, before the Quran was revealed. Notice here, if this statement in the Quran was not true, if it were not true, I should say, then somebody could have said, no, I am an Arab like you, I lived in the same environment, and I knew these stories. But no single person, even those who just wanted to bother him,
mm-hmm.
and to irritate the movement of, or the tide of Islam, or to stop it, or stem it, could not even raise an objection and say, no, I knew it. Nor could any outsider say, no, we know that you people are familiar with these stories. The challenge was made, and it is a fact that people actually didn't know about that.
Yes.
Where did the Prophet get this information? Again, we said that the subconscious is a very, very poor explanation of such meticulous and detailed, in some cases, and very precise information. Similar citations, just for the sake of time, can be found, for example, in Surah 12, in Ayah 3, in Chapter 19, about the story of Mary, the mother of Jesus, peace be upon him. We find also there is mention of the same theme, that these are new information that not the Prophet or his companions or people in his area had any knowledge of that. That's why one scholar of the Quran, Dr. Jaz, ended by saying that some of the opponents of the Prophet in the past, in his lifetime, were smarter than some of the contemporary critics.
Mm-hmm.
You know why? He said they were intelligent enough not to say that, you know, you got this information from your subconscious or whatnot. But to make another accusation that's found, for example, in Surah 25, Ayah 5, that, oh, these are stories he must have learned from some other sources, but again could not reply to the question that this was not known to anyone in that area. How did he get this information from?
Mm-hmm. Well, how about the question now of future events or the prophecies in the Quran? Can you give a few examples of prophecies that couldn't have possibly come from the subconscious of the Prophet?
Okay, there are a number of them, and all of them are characterized by definitiveness. It is not something that may happen. It's put in such a way as if it's something decided. None of the prophecies that we find in the Quran was proven to be false, and we're talking now 1400 years after the Quran was revealed. Now, many people can say, all right, there are astrologers, there are many people who make lots of prophecies that come true, but nobody can say without any fault, even after 1400 years, no single flaw in any prophecy. I think that's too much. Mm-hmm. And to say that subconscious or contemplation. And after all, the Prophet was neither astrologer or somebody who claims, you know, any other way of reaching information except what has been revealed to him directly from God. But some of these prophecies, for example, relate to a definite statement in the Quran that Islam would be preserved, it will be protected, its prophet will be protected, its book will be protected from loss or change, and all of these have proven to be absolutely correct, none of which proved to be false. Just to give reference for those who might wish to make further research on that, a statement like that could be found in 1424, 159, in 616, and many others. This is just an example of this kind of prophecies. But what is interesting is that many of these revelations came to the Prophet in the Meccan period. And that's quite significant. Mm-hmm. Because in the Meccan period, the Prophet and his companions were under severe persecution. And they had only a handful of followers. And mostly the weak and downtrodden people. And at that time, there was no way that one can predict mm-hmm. or prophesy that they will succeed. Not only this, historically we know that there were many prophets and reformers who came under circumstances where everything was in favor of their success, but all of a sudden they were killed or something happened and their message was stopped. How could anyone in the Meccan period, under these very adverse conditions, predict with precision and definitiveness that this will happen and that you will have victory? Look at it also historically after the fact. In the history of Islam, there have been many tragedies, tragedy after tragedy. There have been lots of bloodshed, and Muslims were murdered in the thousands and tens of thousands. Their books were burned, copies of the Quran were burned and trampled upon. Billions of dollars were spent to try to confuse the message of Islam or present it not in its reality, to drive people away from it. But despite all of that, Islam continued to grow. And as many missionaries admit, it is the fastest spreading religion today, and both among people who are illiterate as well as among people who are highly literate. Again, how could anyone 1400 years ago make this definitive type of prophecy that this will happen? For example, in Surah 2 in the Quran, in Ayah 24, a challenge was made that even if the entire mankind and jinn, unseen creatures, combine together to produce something or imitate the Quran, they won't be able to do it. We are now 1400 years or more after that, and nobody had that claim that he could have anything similar, not even identical, similar to the Quran in its literal beauty or contents. In Surah 5, in Ayah 67, there is a definite promise that God will protect the Prophet. And as we said before, that was not necessarily the case with all prophets. Some prophets were killed. But that was said, and said very clearly in the Quran. And that's why, as narrated in At-Tirmidhi and Al-Hakim, it said that when this verse was revealed, that God will protect you from people, mm-hmm. the Prophet, some people were volunteering to help, you know, like guard him. He said, go. God has taken care of protecting me. There were many other incidents in history where his life was at stake, and he was very cool and very comfortable, because he knew that the promise of God in that verse will be fulfilled, and that nobody would be able to kill him. So in the most dangerous moments, he was shouting, "I am the prophet, there is no lie about it," as narrated, for example, in Bukhari, in Muslim, and Ahmad. There are prophecies about the general destiny of the believing group and the unbelieving group. For example, the famous verse in the Quran that God has made a promise, or had made a promise to those who believe and did good deeds, that he will establish their religion for them, and that he will give them power to rule on earth, and so on, and give the reasons and the qualification that they have to have believed and good deeds and all that. Mm-hmm. And again, that came to pass. And as you know, when Muslims were true to their faith, more than half of the known world was under their rule, and we had a civilization that was quite unique in its humanitarian orientation, as well as the great scientific progress that it attained. We discussed that in some detail in the series on economic system. In Surah 48, there is mention also of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah that we may analyze at a later time, of a promise made under the most adverse conditions. Yes. That all came to pass. To conclude, none of the tens of the prophecies that the Quran speak about have proven to be untrue even after the passage of 1400 years. I don't think that one can say reasonably that all of these are a result of just wishful thinking or the so-called subconscious.
Indeed. Mind. Well, we will have to conclude our program with that. I want to thank you for watching. Invite you back next week. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.